The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
And there were opportunities for jobs in Las Vegas. It's a service town. There's tons of things.
You could go bartend for some amount of money.
Yes, yes. But everyone in the club scene knew that part of their year was just filing for unemployment, not even looking for a job.
And doing nothing.
Doing nothing.
Just doing whatever they wanted with their day.
And sometimes you have to fake like you're looking for a job. And I don't know that anyone even followed through with that.
I doubt
it. Just make up a place that they were going to. So I saw this abuse occurring at a small scale.
Yeah, these people were making over six figures a year, working part of the year, and then still collecting unemployment.
Yes. Incentives are powerful. That's the thing. Like, you can control a system by structuring incentives.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was an excerpt from a Charlie in Bed podcast. People don't want to work. I don't know if you've ever seen that lately. Coming up, there's a brand new book out by a friend of mine, Nick Epperstadt. He's going to be stopping by in a few minutes. We'll talk about what we're seeing culturally. I mean, yeah, unemployment numbers are low, but there's plenty of positions open. You might be a small business owner. You're wondering, can't get anybody to work for me. We'll take a look at why that is coming up. But I do want to get you plugged in. If you were just listening and if you missed the conversation, go to the podcast for the Drew Mariani Show and you can hear about Disney's new program, which glorifies Satan. It's terrible. I don't want to rehash all the details of it. I'd rather talk about something a little more positive. I want to give you, as I said, the antidote to that poison. There is programming out there that is fun. It's exciting. It is dramatic, it's suspenseful, and it's brand new, and it's an audio venture. You can listen to it in your car, on that long trip, or on that short ride. You can listen to it in part. You can listen to it while you jog or walk. You can listen to it at work. You can do it as a family. Gather around and spend some time together. Shut off all the other, you know, tablets and TVs and computers and get aboard the exciting new Night Train. Yeah, there's a program that is going to be launching. I'll tell you about it this weekend. It's called On the Night Train, produced by the Merry Beggars. And it leaves the station soon. So we hope you join the Pullman passengers. Subscribe for this. You'll be reminded. And it's super simple. The producer of that, incredible work. And I had a conversation, Peter, with our, let me set you up. Peter Atkinson, my colleague here, joins me, founder of the Merry Beggars. I was having a conversation with our executive vice president of programming. And he just said, man, the stuff that came out has just been off the charts. Super exciting. He got a sneak peek at it. Why don't you fill everyone in on what's going on, why this really is such a wonderful family-oriented source of programming, what they all experience and how it's going to play out.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a joy to be talking to you about this because it, you know, as we were talking in the last segment, it's a huge, huge need in our culture. Kim, the last caller, was talking about the fact that she was in working with Disney and how to support animators who want to do good work, but they don't want to work for Disney or other companies who they don't necessarily agree with or there's work that's against their faith. And I think that's why the Merry Beggars is so important. So for those who don't know, the Merry Beggars is the entertainment division of Relevant Radio. And On the Night Train is the new show that we're launching this Sunday, the 11th of September at 6 p.m. Central. And if we don't have shows like that, if we don't have alternative entertainment, then all we do is complain about the culture. And I feel really called that we're called to create the culture and not just comment on it. Because otherwise you just end up complaining and your kids are watching Disney at the end of the day. So we have to fix this. No one else is going to do it. So it's a pretty exciting task.
So why don't you, and I know we have a little bit of audio, but I mean, you can set that up and throw to it, but tell everyone what the Night Train, what the story is all about, and what they'll experience over the course of the weeks ahead.
Yeah, so the Night Train is a 21-part mystery adventure audio series that we've spent 2 years producing this so that families around the United States can listen to this, can try and solve the mystery together, and can just enjoy a beautiful classic adventure story. It follows two kids, Edith and Paul Mallard. They're on board their father's Night Train as it races across America. It's in a competitive race against another train to see who can be the fastest passenger train across America in the 1880s. When sabotage starts happening to the Night Train, it's up to them to solve the mystery and save the Night Train. There's going to be weekly episodes. They're about 30 to 35 minutes. You can listen to them on any podcast platform, Spotify, Apple, the Relevant Radio app, anywhere that you listen to podcasts. And it's going to be a wild ride. The executive of programming, Mike, that you were talking about, he got to listen to the first episode, and every time I've seen him since, he's just asked me, what happens in the next episode? What happens in episode two? So we think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I don't know if it's for public dissemination or he was telling me about a little 2-minute video trailer that came out. I don't know if that's launching or it's even public yet, but he said that was pretty phenomenal too. So, Peter, I'm super excited. I really am. I also know you're going to be on with Cal Clark coming up in probably about 50 minutes, 40, you know, maybe a little bit after. I'm not quite sure what time he's getting you on, but in the next hour, you will be here and you can go ahead and unpack even more of this. But I know we brought some audio. Would you do me a favor and maybe let's play a little bit of this just so people can hear the quality and what they're going to be getting?
Yeah, so this is this clip is from the very beginning of episode one, and it begins with two news barkers in the streets shouting the news of 1880. So let's have a listen.
Good morning, Chicago. Wake up. The world is changing. Don't be left behind.
It is New Year's Eve, last day of 1879. Read all about how George Pullman and Webster Wagner are celebrating the dawn of 1880. With a race across
America. Morning news is hot off the press. The first passenger trains to attempt crossing the Transcontinental Railroad. Hear about the Webster Wagner's miracle
of
train travel.
The United States of America is more than ready to begin a new decade. Ready to stretch their boundaries and forge ahead into the future.
Get your Wednesday copy of the Chicago Times right here, right now. George Pullman's Night Train is ready for the race across America.
The Merry Beggars presents...
All aboard!
On the Night Train. Episode 1. The Night Train.
Really great stuff, Peter. Really, really great stuff. I am very excited. So before I let you go, could you do me a favor? How do people get connected to this? I know sometimes you start listening to these things. If you're not subscribed, you miss the episode, and sometimes it'd be complicated. I know you really work to streamline that.
Yeah, so we tried to make it as easy as possible. If you find it on any podcast platform, you can just subscribe there on Spotify, Apple, so on and so forth. If you want to make sure that you never miss an episode, you can go to onthenighttrain.com and put your email in, and we'll send you an email with the new episode, so on and so forth. And if you're a Relevant Radio listener, you can go to the Relevant Radio website or app, and there's some banners that you can click there to get to the website.
All right, well, keep up your good work. We'll talk again, hopefully maybe next week. I'd love to catch up again. I look forward to the episode. Again, September 11th, it launches. So all details there at Relevant Radio. Peter, we'll catch up soon. Good seeing you today.
Sounds good, Drew. Always a pleasure.
Right, brother. Thanks. That's Peter Atkinson. Say a prayer for that initiative, too. I think we need more of it, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Just the beginning of some great stuff that Relevant Radio and the Merry Beggars have in your future. That's all part of what Relevant Radio is doing. We now have an entertainment division, and we're bringing light and goodness to the culture and to the world. I think that is that's noble. And thank you, because you made it possible. You know, your support makes all of this quality programming available. We're more than just a radio station, right? More than a radio network. We're doing so much to bring truth and beauty and goodness and light and fun to the world. All right, I'm going to take a short pause here. When I come back, let's talk about people not working. It's bizarre, isn't it? New book out by my next guest, Nicholas Eberstadt. You're going to find this conversation quite telling. Stay with me.
The Drew Mariani Show.
Connected.
Connected.
Relevant Radio.
Relevant Radio runs on horsepower. Your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep your station running. Join in with thousands of other listeners who have given their unused vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
I don't want to work. I want to bang on the drum all day. I don't.
Yeah, it seems to be the theme song for a lot of people. The Labor Department reported today that U.S. workers filing for unemployment benefits fell for the fourth straight week last week. That's a sign of continued tightness in the labor market. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. It's a piece I saw not too long ago. But look, initial joblessness claims, they fell to about 222,000 last week. They revised that number to 228,000 the previous week. And the Journal claimed that we've been ticking down in August after moving up earlier in the summer. But here's the strange thing about this. And Dr. Nicholas Eberstadt is going to be joining us in a second. The number of able-bodied people who are not working, it's in the millions. It is in the millions. In fact, my next guest says that unfilled non-farm positions have averaged over about 11 million a month for the past year. For every unemployed person in the U.S. today, there are nearly two open jobs. I'm not making this up. This is reality. I'm trying to give you truth. And I'm telling you, it's impacting every region of our country. Ever since the pandemic started in our country in March of 2020 with the shutdown of these businesses, people just haven't gone back to work. You know, the nation's reopened. I can't tell you how many people I know just aren't going back to work. I go to this, there was a pizza shop I loved because I was in the Midwest and there was an Italian, New York style pizza place, and it made the best pizza. The place was awesome. I tried to frequent. I went in there one day and they said, "We're closing our doors." I'm like, "Oh, why, man? Business been that slow?" "No, we have more business than we can handle. We just don't have the people. So we're closing this one down. We have another one across town." I mean, so instead of having two businesses that prosper, they have one. People say it's hard to find employees to help you at the grocery store, to work in the big box store. A friend of mine told me that a big box store in his area regularly shuts down their gun desk because they don't have enough employees who are certified to sell guns, so they can't find them. It extends to more than just retail. You got healthcare, nursing homes. They can't find people to care for the elderly. How about mechanics, right? They've cut back on hours because they can't find people who can repair cars. The list goes on. A lot of jobs that require people to show up on time, show up regularly, be drug-free, and want to work, right? Dr. Nicholas Eberstadt, he's a political economist, a demographer, and the Henry Went Scholar in Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute. He just wrote a book. It's called Men Without Work, Post-Pandemic Edition. I actually have it in my hand. It just arrived, so I have yet to dive into this. Looking forward to it. He joins me today. Doctor, congratulations on your book. I really can't wait to read this.
Thank you so much, Drew. Thank you for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
Now, I am delighted by your analysis, your observations, and, of course, your writing here. I mean, it's crazy what we're seeing in the country. This phenomenon of people not working, of course, it's not new. I know you document that in your first edition of your book that came out a couple years ago. So just tell us, what's changed between what you released? I know this is the post-pandemic edition. What did the pandemic do? What's the mindset today? What are you seeing?
When I came out with Men Without Work in 2016, I was talking about an invisible crisis in our country, about the continuing flight from work by men 25 to 54 years old. By the time I wrote the book initially, the work rate for prime age men was down to basically late Great Depression era levels. It was a depression scale crisis. In the new edition, that takes us up more or less to right now, I argue that we've gone from men without work to work without men or women. That's the 11 million unfilled jobs that you're talking about, Drew. And it's an astonishing peacetime labor shortage. And this is despite having more bargaining power in the hands of workers today during this great resignation than at any time, in my memory, in my living memory. Markets are supposed to solve market problems, but we have about 3 or 4 million fewer people in the workforce today than we would have had on pre-pandemic trends. So there are millions and millions of people who went out of the workforce and didn't come back, and they're not just the prime age guys. This men without work syndrome, unfortunately, seems to be spreading to other groups.
I'm just stunned by it. I had a work ethic ever since I was a young kid. I just don't understand how people can get by? Is it that they're not concerned about a sense of security? Is it a sense of entitlement? Have things changed? Have people been given so much that the more that they have been given, the more that they expect? I mean, what's the psychology behind this? What have you found in terms of what the driver for this behavior is?
Well, of course, I mean, we did just come out of a catastrophe. A million people or more have died of the pandemic. I don't want to make light of that or minimize that. There are probably some people who have long COVID who are out of the workforce because of that. There are others who may be out of the workforce taking care of people who have been affected by the pandemic, not just the COVID, but as you know, the opioid deaths have spiraled upwards during this time period. But I look at the unintended consequences of government policy also. And I think that we can see that an awful lot of people have retired from the labor force or maybe prematurely retired from the labor force because they have been deciding to live off of COVID policy lottery winnings. Right. It's an enormous amount of money that the government transferred to the population to try to mitigate the crisis. And indeed, the transfers were so enormous that that incomes and savings went up during the crisis. Yeah. People are living off of some of that.
Yeah, that's really true. It's such a great point. You know, when COVID was underway, there was talk in a number of states about UBI, Universal Basic Income, where they want to test this out in pockets, California, Chicago, places like that, where they'd give everyone $500 a month or they would give X amount of dollars to them just so people could have that type of money and maybe spend it and use it in the economy. I think that's a terrible idea. And correct me if I'm wrong. I'd love to your perspective on this. But if we're already seeing what government handout has done, taking away, you know, motive and initiative. And as you pointed out, too, there's a lot of people with legitimate reasons for not working. We're not talking about those. What are your thoughts on universal basic income, that model, the theory behind it? Would it be good for this country, or would it be, it almost seems socialistic to me in some respects. Would it be deadly? How do you view something like that, a policy like that that's thrown around?
Well, I'd make two points, Drew. First point, we kind of got a universal basic income for a year and a half as the government was scrambling with this pandemic unemployment insurance $600 a week benefit, then the $300 a week benefit. Remember those? You didn't have to be unemployed to get them. And the income cutoff was pretty high. Wow. So we actually had about a year of a test drive nationwide for a UBI. And secondly, I think that UBI is a terrible policy for the recipients, not for the taxpayers. It's not great for taxpayers, don't get me wrong, but for the recipients. I mean, take a look at what is happening now with men who are neither working nor looking for work. What they report to the government in the time use surveys, they don't do civil society. They don't go to worship, basically, or volunteer or charity. They've got all of this time, but they do very little help around the house or help with other members of the house. They sit in front of screens 2,000 hours a year. This is what they report. And they also report an awful lot of pain pill use. Do we really want to buy more of that for our society?
No. That's actually, you know, I didn't know those stats. I didn't know those facts. That's fascinating. Disengagement from God, you know, greater increase in pain pills, a whole litany of things. Fascinating to me. You pointed out in a recent Wall Street Journal article, most of the jobs that are open, they're really not that hard to do. Just, you know, show up regularly, be on time, be drug free. Is part of the problem that people want something more out of work than simply being a cog in a wheel for somebody else? Or does that play any role in this at all? Or you know, what are your observations when it comes to the fact that these jobs are not, they're not picking, you know, strawberries in a field or cotton someplace? I mean, you're working in a store, and like I said, the jobs really aren't that difficult to do. Your thoughts on that? I mean, what's the mindset behind that? Why don't people want those jobs?
Well, what's really astonishing is that with this enormous glut of unfilled positions. Yeah. You can't make the argument anymore that work isn't to be had. And you can't make the argument anymore that people are kept out of the labor force by skills shortages. Because as you said, there are millions of jobs for which the skills are just going there, being reliable, being sober. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing right now is a problem that can't be solved by the market. If the jobs problem could be solved by the market, it would have been solved already. We're seeing a social pathology.
Wow.
And some of this is people who have, as I say, prematurely retired. Some of it is people who can't be lured back into the job market for love or money. Some people will come back after they spend their, what you might call the wealth effects of COVID policies, but it's looking like a number of people may not, and that's sad for them. It's not great for our economy, it's not great for our society, but it's sad for them because work is a service to others that helps complete you, and anybody who's had a job for a lot of their life knows that the fulfillment that comes from the success that you generate in work, no matter what your station.
Well, I guess today, Dr. Nicholas Eberstadt, if you want to join us, feel free to dial in. The number's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I will go to the phones in just a moment. I only have a moment or two left for the good doctor, another 10 minutes or so. But, let me go to the phones now. I'll make sure I get them in, and I'll indulge my own questions in a minute. Mike is listening in Annapolis, Maryland. Mike, it's good to hear from you. Welcome.
Hey, Drew, nice to hear from you. I just want to let you know I'm going to Sheboygan, Wisconsin in a couple weeks.
There you go.
So. Hey, yeah. I have a comment and a question, and that is I agree with the fact that some of these government policies have exacerbated the problem, but isn't your guest downplaying the issue of demographics? We're just getting older, and there's people we've known about the baby boomers retiring out of the workforce for years, and your guest touched on it briefly. Yeah. We lost several hundred thousand people of working age due to the pandemic. And then, we've had commercial truck driver shortages for 10-plus years.
Yeah.
And I just make my own personal observation. Every fast food restaurant I've driven by in the last 10 years has had a help wanted sign out in front of it. So yeah. I think there's just so a little too much emphasis on the pandemic here and not maybe on what are a long-term situation, which is the demographic aging of the United States.
Mike, it's a great insight. Before I let you go and I let him respond, what are you doing in Sheboygan? Work or pleasure?
I'm going to work, unfortunately.
All right. Well, have a great trip.
I need to drive up and come see you.
Yeah, you should. Well, our network studios are in Lincolnshire, Illinois. Of course, the Green Bay studios are great to see, too, and you're close to so many of those wonderful national shrines like the Shrine of Our Lady of Good Help and others. Mike brings up a great point. Mike, let me let him respond to that because I only have a few minutes with him. I'll take a few more calls, too. I mean, it's a valid point. I mean, demographics play a role in this. Maybe it's not just the pandemic as well. What are you seeing? What kind of role, what kind of relation, what percentage of these numbers is perhaps retirements, old age, changing demographics?
Mike made great points and great observations. With respect to the observation, there always are unfilled jobs in the U.S. You know, we've got an economy. You know, people leave, people come in. But the total number of unfilled jobs jumped by about 4 or 5 million since before the pandemic. So the total has gone up extraordinarily. That's why we're seeing help wanted signs absolutely everywhere now. Yeah. With regard to the demographics, it's kind of funny, but the only real ray of sunshine in the American employment picture before the pandemic was work rates and workforce participation by older workers, by the 55-plus group. This was the only group where the rates had been going steadily up from the mid-1990s to 2019. They got hammered in the pandemic. And the strange thing is that they haven't really come back. So about half or maybe more of the new shortfall is people who are 55 plus, and their workforce participation rates have been set way back.
Well, all right, let's move along. John and Mike, thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you. John is in Wisconsin, has another observation. Dr. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Maybe there's a little off the subject, but I can think of about 60 million workers and their progeny who just are not around due to the years and years of row in the United States.
That's a great point. How many souls have been lost through Roe v. Wade? Was it 64 million? Something like 60 million plus, right? So that's a great observation, too, Doctor. What role, you know, you talk about retirement is one thing, and Mike brought that point up, but we're missing a whole generation of people who could be filling these jobs as well. You know, I don't know if Roe factors into what you're observing, but what role does this missing demographic play in the nation's economy?
It's a really, really interesting question, and I don't think I can put a decimal point on it. I can make two observations, though, about it. One is that work and family, work and religiosity are very, very tightly bound together. And what we have seen over the past generation, as you know, is a disintegration of our family structure. And since about 2008, we've seen a plunge in religiosity in the United States. It would be preposterous to think that these two big trends didn't have an impact on the workforce, on our work ethic, and on our social fabric, including our connection to work.
Yeah, that's so true. Tom's listening in Wisconsin, 888-914-9149. That's the number to join us. Hi, Tom. Good afternoon. Hey, Tom, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to weigh in a little bit on this. I'm just curious how you feel that this whole social justice movement and CRT is kind of weighing in on this, because I'll tell you from my experience with working with young people in my business, that seems to be a big weighing factor, and those on the side of basically agreeing with this whole movement just feel like they shouldn't have to work. There's entitlement. And going by something you just said earlier, I too had a situation where I was talking to an individual in the town that I live in that runs a restaurant, and he can't find any help. And he's like, all these kids, as soon as they get to the part where they have to do dishes or anything like that, they just walk away because they don't want to do the job. And I mean, I'm sure some of it has to do with, you know, lower wages before COVID hit,
right,
being a bigger problem. And then when you get handed money, and a lot of times it was more money than some of these kids were making, you know, it's a lot harder to get them to come back to work.
All right. Hey, Tom, thank you for the call. Let me let the doctor respond. Dr. CRT, Critical Race Theory, Social Justice Platforms, he's making the case that that has had an impact on what we're seeing here. Do you see that playing out?
Well, think of it. If you are taught to think of yourself as a victim.
Victim, yep.
If you are taught to think of yourself as somebody who needs to be, you know, propitiated or, you know, appeased, yep, to have the world made right for them, that's not the way that you're going to be building skills and earning success in the world. Right. And the job market is a fantastic way to build your own self-esteem and to build your skills and to earn your own success. It's a way of kind of, it's almost putting it upside down. And during the pandemic, the savings rates for the United States doubled. It was supposed to be an economic crisis, but because of borrowed money, U.S. savings rates doubled. So the public had $2.5 trillion of extra government borrowed money in their pockets at the end of 2021, and it went to a lot of people, and some people used it to supplement their work.
Yeah.
Some people used it to substitute for it.
You got it. Well, Doctor, look, we could spend the rest of the hour talking, but I got to leave it right here. I'm curious. The new book, it's called Post-Pandemic Edition, Men Without Work by Dr. Nicholas Eberstadt. Where can people get it? What will they find in this? If they're curious about why we're seeing what we're seeing, I'm sure this will be a phenomenal read. It just arrived literally, I think, the other day here, so I have yet to dive into it. I'm looking forward to it. It looks like a very simple read. It's not that deep, but how do we get it? How do people pick it up?
You can, I guess, nowadays, I think you'd probably go to your favorite online book seller, order it from there. It's called Men Without Work, Post-Pandemic Edition. You can just type in those words into the internet, and you'll see where you can purchase it and where you which of your favorite places you can get it from.
That's great. I'm going through it right now. I'm seeing all the graphs and the charts. It's fascinating stuff. Great chapters. Men Without Work, jot it down. Do a quick search. The last name is Eberstadt, E-B-E-R-S-T-A-D-T. All right? You can check him out. Hey, Doc, always good to have you here. Thank you for making time for us. You and I will catch up again soon, okay?
Thank you, dude. God bless.
God bless you. That's Dr. Nicholas Eberstadt. Let me take a short pause. When I return, I'll bring you up to speed on another story that you really should hear about. I mean, there's been so much. I've been away from the mic for a few days, as you know. Boy, we got a lot to catch up on. Dr. Aaron Cariotti, another great friend of the broadcast, is going to be stopping by. And wait to hear what he's got to share. Stay with me. We'll dive into that and more.
Live, coast to coast, the Drew Mariani Show is on Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
There's a human right not enshrined in any constitution, and that is the right to truth. And no right has been more systematically trammeled in the last 2 years than this one. Our ruling class has seen in COVID an opportunity to revolutionize society. With vaccine mandates and vaccine passports, we're seeing the emergence of what I call a biosecurity surveillance regime. The welding of digital technologies, public health, and police power are leading to unprecedented invasions on our privacy and intrusive methods of control.
You're listening to Drew Mariani on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, those were the powerful words of my next guest, Dr. Aaron Cariotti, reflecting on the lessons learned during COVID-19. He has an amazing story to share. Let me tell you what's happening here, and we'll talk with him a little bit about this. About 10 days ago, the California State Legislature, they passed a bill, and it punishes doctors who, in the lawmaker's mind, pass on misinformation to their patients about COVID, especially about vaccines. So you can imagine where that goes, right? According to the New York Times, the law would designate spreading false or misleading medical information to patients as, quote, unprofessional conduct, subject to punishment by the agency that licenses doctors, the Medical Board of California. Wow, it's a mouthful, isn't it? So that could include suspending or revoking a doctor's license to practice medicine in the state. And it doesn't include information posted online or other public forums, right? Just in one-on-one patient interaction. So the governor there, Governor Newsom, we don't know what he's going to do. He hasn't indicated whether he's going to sign it. He hasn't said anything about it yet. He has until the end of the month to do that. And, of course, there's no legislation being considered that would punish public officials, right, who tell the public that they have to follow certain medical standards, like you need to wear a mask in public, or then you look at these guys and they don't follow that medical standard themselves, right? They go maskless at public gatherings and hang out with their wealthy friends. Is there a consequence for that action? Probably not, right? So the bill's opposed. It's being opposed. And if Newsom signs it, there will be more than likely court action against it. Why? It violates the right of free speech. It also violates the right of the doctors to give their best medical judgment to their patient, whether or not that judgment is supported by the AMA, the American Medical Association. So one of the doctors who is actually opposing it is my next guest. And Dr. Cariotti is had been a professor of psychiatry at the University of California at Irvine before he actually spoke up against the school, forcing all the doctors to toe the line on taking the COVID-19 vaccines. And we've talked to him about this, especially if they had natural immunity, right, from the disease. So Cariotti is now the chief of psychiatry and ethics at Doc One Health, Chief of Ethics at the Unity Project. It's a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and also a senior fellow at the Zephyr Institute. And look, it goes on and on. He's there at Brownstone and give you a whole litany of other things. He's well sought after. He's a fellow at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, and he joins us today. If you want to find him, here's the best way. AaronCariotti.com. Last name is K-H-E-R-I-A-T-Y. AaronCariotti.com. Great story. He's got a lot to share, and he's here today. Doctor, welcome. Thank you for your patience. Good to have you back.
Thanks, Drew. It's always good to be with you.
You know, you testified in Sacramento against this bill, from what I understand. I'm curious. I don't know what the reaction from the legislators to your testimony was like. What was the response? How did they respond to that? How did they react?
Yeah, so several people on the committee that I testified in front of, several of the California state senators did share my concerns. Unfortunately, they were not the majority of members of that committee, so it ended up passing to that committee and passed on the Senate floor, really along strict party lines. Unfortunately, these COVID issues have become so politicized that people feel that their tribal loyalties sort of trump a critical view of science or a nuanced understanding of science and medicine. But basically what I told them, Drew, was that ultimately this bill, which is poised to punish physicians who state anything in a clinical setting that contradicts basically what the state of California, what the public health authorities in California are recommending, that physician could be disciplined by the medical board. Basically, that means you could have your medical license removed. So this is worse than, let's say, just getting fired from a hospital. If I get fired from a hospital or a school of medicine where I work, I can go start a private practice, which is what I did in California after the University of California let me go. That was following upon me challenging their vaccine mandate in federal court, but was able to set up a private practice down here in Southern California. But if the medical board disciplines me and revokes my license, that basically takes away my ability to practice medicine, my entire livelihood. So this is the kind of punishment that's being hung over the head of physicians is so severe that no physician is going to come anywhere near, you know, doing anything that may run afoul of this law. Now, what might run afoul of this law? It's really hard to say, because basically the definition of misinformation in the law is defined by the notion of consensus. So, you know, what constitutes a medical or a public health consensus? Well, I think most doctors are going to just interpret that as whatever the state of California says. You know, whatever position the California Department of Health is taking, I have to toe the line, even if I disagree with it. Now, I say this will harm patients and not just physicians, because patients have to be able to trust their physicians, right? If you go to your doctor and you ask your doctor a question, whether it's about a COVID vaccine or whether it's about, any other COVID-related measure, you know, do masks work? Should I practice social distancing? Is it safe for me to work in person? Is it safe for me to be around my elderly parents who haven't had COVID yet? Whatever.
Right.
You want your physician to be able to tell you what he or she actually thinks. You know, their interpretation of the evidence, their understanding of the issue, their reading of the medical literature. You cannot trust a physician who can't be honest with you. You cannot trust a physician who has a gag order. Now, you might be skeptical about your doctor's advice. You might go seek a second opinion just to get another perspective. Great. Patients have a right to do that. Yep. But I don't think any patient, regardless of whether ultimately they end up agreeing or disagreeing with their physician's recommendation, I don't think any patient wants a physician not to be able to tell the patient what they think. And that's basically what this law does. It also makes it, therefore, impossible for physicians to practice informed consent. So if I have information I think is relevant to my patient that I'm not allowed to disclose to the patient, I'm only allowed to sort of parrot or repeat back to them what a state health agency is saying, then that does not really constitute informed consent. And, you know, any doctor who does that should be quite uncomfortable with that. So this violates the conscience of the physician. This also... this also impairs the advance and progress of science, because science is not the practice of science and the advance of science is not characterized by consensus. It's characterized by conjecture and refutation and hypothesis and debate. And you take a group of a dozen scientists who do real, you know, cutting-edge scientific work. You put them in a room together. Let's say they're all studying the same problem or the same area of science. What are they going to do? They're going to argue endlessly, right? About the latest study, about the methods, about the upshot or the overall, you know, relevance of the evidence. You know, that's what is characteristic of good science, and that's how science progresses. Trying to foreclose debate, you know, just because some public health bureaucrat came down on one side of a question about a particular intervention, that's going to basically hamstring the progress of science. Science and censorship are just simply incompatible.
Yeah. So if the bill signed, it's supposed to impact what doctors say directly to their patients, right? That brings to my mind the whole thing about abortion, right? It's between a woman and her doctor, right? Isn't that the argument that we always heard? It's between a woman and her doctor. So if abortion's only between a woman and her doctor, why is what a doctor says to the patient about COVID open to public scrutiny? I mean, I don't understand how they can parse and what happens to the logic they use in one case and why it's disengaged with another.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's an excellent question and an excellent point. I don't think this law can withstand honest, careful, constitutional, judicial scrutiny. I mean, I think it's a clear violation of First Amendment free speech rights for physicians. It's also a clear violation of the basic tenets and principles of medical ethics. Because that the reason the doctor-patient relationship is given this kind of regard in society is, you know, what happens between you and your doctor is private, it's confidential. It's because the questions that you discuss with your doctor are personal, private, very charged, and have serious implications for your life. And also because medicine requires individualizing care to the patient. Right, so a public health agency may have a general recommendation for the population as a whole, but it may or may not apply to a specific patient in specific circumstances with specific illnesses that maybe that one physician is the expert on in California, right? And so the general guideline, which is what public health agencies should do, they should issue general guidelines, not dictates, not directives, not policies, not laws, guidelines. And as with any other guidelines, physicians use guidelines to inform their decision-making, but those guidelines don't dictate their decision-making, right? Otherwise, you know, iPads could practice medicine. You just plug somebody into an algorithm, and it'll spit out an answer on the other end. But medicine obviously doesn't work that way. So the individualized nature of the doctor-patient relationship, at least when it comes to discussing COVID-related measures, which is what this law focuses on, that's going to be destroyed by this law. So you're carving out this weird area within medicine in regards to this particular illness where the usual rules don't apply. That just can't work. I mean, it just plain can't work. That good doctors will not practice under those circumstances. They'll simply pick up and move and leave the state and go someplace where they can have honest conversations with their patients and don't have this guillotine from the state sort of hanging over their head.
Yep. Yeah. Whatever happened to doctor-patient privilege? I mean, that seems to be thrown out the door too, doesn't it? I mean,
absolutely. Yeah.
No longer respected.
Yeah. I mean, this is the straight state intruding on that private domain, which federal law protects.
Crazy.
And so I just don't think this can hold up. I'm a little surprised that Newsom hasn't signed the law. The bill into law already, because, you know, this would be consistent with his whole approach during the COVID pandemic and certainly the approach of his party in the state that pushed this through the state legislature. But, you know, maybe he's getting some reasonable advice from legal counsel that, you know, look, if you pass this law, it's not going to withstand a First Amendment challenge. You don't want to be in a position to have a law that you signed struck down in federal court. So I don't know. I mean, my guess is that he's going to sign it, and then it'll be probably a long, protracted legal battle, which ultimately I think, you know, will prevail in the right direction, or at least I hope, if you get an honest judge on the case. They should clearly recognize that this is a problem.
You know, Doctor, the other aspect of this, just kind of a final thought on this. I'll take a few calls, too. If you want to join us, the number to get in, 888-914-9149. Maybe you're a physician and you think this is crazy, or maybe you've got a different perspective on it. Feel free to dial in. I have a couple minutes left with Dr. Cariotti, but the number's 888-914-9149. I always step back, and I wonder who's the arbiter of defining, what is misinformation? I mean, who gets to make that decision? Who gave them that authority? Where does it come from? How do they respond to that?
That's a great question. They typically respond to that by citing really sort of fringe examples of things that are said by some people, not necessarily physicians. I mean, in the testimony, no one cited an example of a physician saying that, Bill Gates is implanting a chip in your brain by means of this vaccine. They talk about theories that, most people would sort of reject out of hand, and make the claim that this kind of misinformation on the internet is dissuading people from getting vaccinated. They were never able to cite a single example of a physician saying something like that to a patient in a clinical setting, which is what's relevant for this law. I mean, this law can't and won't stop anyone from posting something on social media, some theory about the vaccine. So they hold up a sort of straw man, a sort of red herring of some fringe idea that, that they characterize as dangerous and most people can recognize as kind of, probably doesn't have a lot of evidence in favor of it. Let's just say that. But if you actually look at the language of the law, which is what's going to matter when it comes down to it, it's not some fringe example. It's what does the law say? Well, the law defines misinformation in relation to consensus, which is very vague and nebulous when it comes to science and medicine.
It is.
And because the penalty is so severe, I think, even if the law is not enforced, or maybe with one or two public examples of a physician who's disciplined under the law, it's just going to have a chilling effect on the entire profession. And I think that is actually the intention of the law, is just to make doctors fall in line and not question anything that the state of California wants to do in terms of its public health measures.
Just a couple other things. I have a few moments left. I'm curious. A friend of mine, Wesley Smith, he's another contributor to this program. He wrote a piece for, I think it was National Review, and he says that the scientific establishment is, they moan that they're no longer trusted, right? But there's good cause, right? The leadership of these hard science sectors, he says they've grown increasingly ideological, undermining science's overall credibility. He made the case. His headline was something like "Progressivism Colonizes the Science Journals." How do you read that? Because this was your area of expertise as well. Is progressivism, has this woke culture, have all the stuff that we're seeing in the culture now taken rational human beings and made them irrational? Because there's one other story, too, I'll get your take on. You could maybe answer both of these. I saw a piece where the U.S. forces have been ordered, and this is insane, to drop male and female pronouns. There's a division in the U.S. Pacific Air Force somewhere. It's a branch tasked with actually confronting China, believe it or not, and they ordered their senior leaders and their commanders stop using gender pronouns in accordance with some rule or law they have. We got to embrace and promote and unleash diversity and inclusion, the email said. Where we're seeing this from the military, a place where I don't think it should be, right? Yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, we shouldn't worry about pronouns, to progressivism now in our scientific journals and in medicine. I mean, chromosomes don't lie. Your thoughts on this and where we're heading, because we see the culture now infiltrating, kind of soaking into some of these, what used to be, impervious, concrete, if you will, institutions.
No, Wesley's absolutely right about that. He's a friend of mine. I saw that piece he published, and certainly this is something I've been thinking about recently, too, as I've observed what's happened recently, accelerated during the pandemic, in medical education. So you have medical schools now, left and right, dropping the requirements for the MCAT, which is sort of the SAT for medical schools. Yeah. Is it a perfect test? No. Is it predictive of success, academic success during medical school? Yes, actually it is. So it's one useful metric for, you know, examining scientific aptitude that's necessary to get through medical school. So they're dropping that requirement. Many med schools are dropping their pre-med science requirements. And sort of dropping standards in the name of diversity, equity, and inclusion, which can only, you know, only have the effect, among other things, of allowing ideology to control who gets in and who doesn't get in to medical school, and sort of ideological purity tests substituting for capacity and competence, you know, in the disciplines and subjects necessary for good medicine. So that's one example. We could talk about the scientific journals. We could talk about the peer review process. We could talk about the small group of influential people that control public funding of scientific research in the United States. Yeah. You know, we could go down any number of those rabbit holes and illustrate this phenomenon.
We'll have to bring you back.
It is happening without a doubt.
I got to leave it right there. My producer, Maggie, actually has a question. I was going to try to get on the air for you, but she'll probably ask it to you off air. So hang out for a second. If you want to follow up on Dr. Cariotti, you can check out AaronCariotti.com. That is his website. Say a prayer for him. He's been through a lot. Say a prayer for me. And I'll do the same for you. Cale Clark is coming up straight ahead.